Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Plenty coming up as always. One of the world's biggest accountancy firms is banned in China. We'll tell you why. And China's producing a lot of cheap electric cars. We talk about that a lot on the programme. The US and the EU's not happy, but what do the Chinese make of them?
Of course, if you care about appearances, you wouldn't use this car to pick up important clients because the car looks cheap.
And the price tag? Just $18,000.
More on those Chinese EVs a little bit later. But let's start the programme by looking at a country that we've talked about a lot this year on the programme, and that is Pakistan, because the political instability there, as we've told you, has led to an economic crisis. There have been lots of headlines like this one.
Pakistan is in crisis. The worst inflation in Asia. Mass protests. Record energy prices.
But could things be about to improve? Pakistan's Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif has said the country has met all the conditions needed to secure a new $7 billion loan from the IMF.
Jo IMF ka bhi inshallah ek marhala baki hai 25 September ko.
That's the Prime Minister there on national television explaining to the people of Pakistan that he expects that crucial deal to be ratified on the 25th of September. And now the country's central bank has also reduced interest rates by 2% to 17.5%. Still high, but a sign that inflation is falling. So is this economy picking up? A question for Mohammed Sahel, the chief executive of Topline Securities, a stockbroking firm based in the financial capital, Karachi.
Look, in the business community, their confidence is improving and there are leading indicators. For instance, stock market has doubled in the last 14, 15 months. The overall large-scale manufacturing, which was falling, has now stabilized. So overall, business confidence is better, but it's still not as good as it used to be.
Can I ask you, you obviously know the private sector very well. For Pakistan to grow economically, it needs the private sector to invest more money into the country. Are people, do you think, confident enough to do that?
Since last few months, we are seeing things stabilizing, and especially this sharp cut in interest rate will now force investors to pull out money from fixed income instruments to their businesses.
Where do you think Pakistan is on its road to economic recovery? Has it just begun the journey?
I think there are two big challenges that Pakistan needs to face. One is this political stability. Although the new government has taken charge, the opposition is very strong. There has been an incident of protest here in Pakistan. So that is the risk number one. The other risk is the government's sincerity in stabilizing the economy. Since last 15 months or so, the government has been serious in stabilizing the economy. But because of the pressure from different coalition partners, there are risks that few economic reforms may get delayed.
Let's pick up on those points from Mohammed there, because the current government has spent the last few months trying to look at different ways to boost economic growth. And they've asked the renowned British economist, Stefan Dercon, to come up with a plan to achieve this. Well, he's done that, and he's been telling me about it and the challenges facing Pakistan.
I think it's there. I'm still optimistic that something of the things we worked on in the last few months will come about, but it has to be their own. It has to be in their words. It has to be their own translation in their own context.
Can I talk to you about the plan? Because this is a country that is struggling economically. It's not growing quickly enough. It doesn't have a wide enough tax base. How can the country grow? It needs private sector investment, But how will it get that when the country looks so unstable?
Of course, it doesn't help that indeed there's issues to do with political stability at times. There's all concerns about different provinces and issues to do with that. But of course, that means on the budgetary side, it needs to find a way of learning to balance the books and dealing with these
things. And it hasn't done that, has it? So how can it start doing it now?
Tax revenue will have to go up, but not in the way that often has happened, that the tax gets taxed more. No, it has to be about broadening the tax base. And there's some effort going on that, you know, from the retail sector, that's much better. And the way that gets taxed.
You would know from your time in Pakistan, there is a very strong feeling that the middle class takes a lot of the burden of taxation, and the rich in Pakistan are not paying their way.
So
that's a fair comment, isn't it?
That's an absolutely fair comment. That will be, I'm sure, be part also of the IMF program. But it's just absolutely essential for the country that they broaden the tax base, that, you know, large landowners need to be taxed, large agricultural farmers need to be taxed. In the retail sector, very small amount of maybe the large shops that pay some tax, and there's objection. Then, it touches also on a lot of vested interests, a lot of people who've got away with not having to do this, while indeed those who are people who are salaried and so on, they've been always paying more and more taxes. And so, the main thing will have to be through much better collection. That's going to be essential.
A lot of people will agree with you. That is what needs to happen. A lot of people we speak to in Pakistan say that is exactly what needs to happen. Yeah. But it hasn't, because there's never been the political will to push this forward. Do you, from your conversations with this administration, the Shahbaz Sharif one, feel that that is about to change?
Will it be? I think there is, you know, the Prime Minister, you know, he always gets described for a long time by commentators and by writers as a kind of managerial type. That's my experience as well. He's very keen to implement, and he's trying to set up some structures in place for implementation. But, you know, this is a hard country. This is a difficult place.
It is a difficult place, but it's also in a difficult place. And if it doesn't solve these problems now, Pakistan, if you look at many of the economic indicators, has slipped way behind India, way behind Bangladesh, hasn't it? Way behind surrounding countries. It is a crucial moment for it.
There's something quite remarkable about Pakistan. It's basically trying to get the 25th IMF program in the world going. That's a record in the world. There's no country that has had so many of these programs. What is really essential is that at the moment, the way the economy is structured, it actually cannot grow. And I just want to be very clear about it. We know from research in Pakistan that whenever the economy starts growing by about 3 or 4%, there will be a balance of payments crisis. And that's to do with the structural conditions of the economy. So this is an economy that exports very little. It doesn't import remarkably much compared to a lot of other countries, but in exports, it virtually doesn't do anything. So it's a structural thing. And the other side of it is then actually to do with investment. Private investment is only about 12% of GDP. That's half the share that, for example, India gets. All other Asian economies will have higher shares. That's what they need to pay the attention to now.
Last question to you, and it's been a fascinating conversation. That cycle of going back to the IMF 25 times, is it possible to break it? Because there are many countries in that cycle. Many people feel that once they get into this cycle, they never get out of it.
Well, no, I wouldn't agree with that. India also went to the IMF, but it did it the last time in 1991. And that's actually the kind of thing where we're actually trying to allude to. And that has a lot to do with trying to change at some point the structure of what you do. So basically, the key for Pakistan is to generally trying to stop the policies that have been implemented around import substitution. That's what got them always further and further behind. Labor productivity growth is 1/10 over the last couple of decades than Vietnam had, and only about 20% of what India achieved. It is actually a lot to do with moving towards what all the other Asian economies have done, being export-oriented. It's a remarkable thing. It's almost the last of the Asian economies that hasn't really taken this on.
Fascinating to hear from the man who's come up with that plan. Let's bring in Chris Lowe, Chief Economist, FHN Financial, based in New York. Familiar voice here on World Business Report. Chris, getting out of that cycle for emerging economies where they constantly are going back to the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, it's not easy, is it?
Raul, no, it is so hard. And, you know, a big part of it, and what India finally did manage in the 90s that Pakistan still has not is reforming and overcoming some of the corruption. And even more important than corruption, the red tape that makes it so difficult to do business and sort of unleashing entrepreneurialism and manufacturing. And it is tricky. But once you turn that corner, you can make tremendous progress very fast.
Well, let's see if it does. Chris, what are your thoughts on this story as well? Russia's central bank on Friday raised its interest rates by 1% to 19%, a widely anticipated move for the country as it struggles to cool down inflation amid soaring military spending. The governor of the central bank of Russia, Elvira Nabiullina, said at a press conference that rates may have to rise again in the future.
Today we decided to raise rates to 19%. Monetary conditions have continued to tighten in recent months, driven by our decisions. Sustainable inflation remains above what is required to return to target next year. Today's decision will strengthen the monetary policy impetus to reduce inflation. We accept that a further increase in the key rates will be required at the next meeting.
Chris, aside that, away from the headlines and what Mr. Putin likes to say, the Russian economy is struggling.
It is struggling. And, you know, honestly, Rahul, this was a striking move. People had been talking about a rate hike, but in just the last couple of days, economists started to think, no, you know, they may be done because growth has slowed so much. So to hear not only a 1% rise at this meeting, but also a promise of more to come potentially as soon as the next one, that was surprising, and it should help stabilize things.
Let's see what happens there. We'll be talking, I'm sure, to you about interest rates next week as we have that decision by the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Central Bank, which has huge implications for the global economy. Let's stay in the U.S. Elon Musk's social media company, X, formerly known, of course, as Twitter, is expected to close its longtime headquarters in San Francisco today. The closely watched move came as the tech entrepreneur's relationship with the state government in California has been increasingly fraught. Let's speak to our technology correspondent, Lily Jamali, now. She's in San Francisco, not going anywhere, I think. Lily, tell us, just remind us why he's moving the headquarters of X.
Yes, of course. Well, we've heard Musk complain about how city leaders in San Francisco have managed public safety in the city, griping that they haven't done enough to keep some areas secure. It's been called the doom loop narrative, and some residents will agree. Others will say it's a bit overblown. But Musk said last year, despite that X was not moving. Then fast forward to this past summer, and things changed when California lawmakers passed new gender identity legislation. This law bans policies requiring school districts to let parents know, to notify them if their children switch names or pronouns at school. And when Governor Gavin Newsom signed that bill into law, Musk called it the final straw. You may know he has a transgender daughter. He's been, you know, critical of policies from the Democratic Party on transgender issues. He's even mocked gender pronouns multiple times. So in July, on the back of that, he said he was moving SpaceX, his rocket company, from California to Texas, then followed, saying X would be moving too.
We've seen this, haven't we, with Elon Musk. Is it a trend that other people are also doing? I mean, California is an expensive part of the U.S. Are we seeing people move to cheaper parts of the country, particularly in the tech world?
Yeah, we have seen this very notable trend of tech employees working from home since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. There is a lot of vacant office space in San Francisco right now. In fact, the city's largest employer, a company called Salesforce, which owns Slack, this is a messaging service that a lot of people use at work. They've been shedding office space to cut costs. So has Meta, which owns Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp. Same with Snap, the parent of Snapchat, which is based in LA, but they did have offices here. I could go on. I mean, I will say there is an effort to get workers to come back to the city. It's spearheaded by local business owners and event organizers. They have this big block party that now happens near downtown every Thursday. They bring food and music and a festive atmosphere to the neighborhood. And it's actually a lot of fun, a good reason for workers who do still have office space to go to downtown to head there.
Well, you know what? You've tempted me. I wouldn't mind going myself. You were down at the offices of X this morning, just paying a picture of what it's like, or what is anything happening there?
Yeah, it was pretty quiet. It was mostly just neighborhood residents, you know, getting their morning cup of coffee or walking their dogs. There weren't a lot of ex-workers around. No obvious signs of furniture being moved out. So the thing is, it's been quiet for a while down there now. And I think, you know, people have gotten used to the lack of foot traffic from Twitter/ex-workers in the neighborhood. I actually asked a neighbor what she thought of them leaving. Mm-hmm. And she said she didn't even know they were still there. And it's true. The signage outside is gone. It feels a little desolate. And so, you know, X's tenure at that location, it's been there for a decade back when it was Twitter. You know, it's ending with a bang, not with a bang, but with more of a whimper, I would say.
Okay, Lily, thank you very much for that. Chris, briefly, if you don't mind. I suppose this reminds us that in the US, you know, states are competing with each other for big companies.
And, you know, a big part of that is tax policies, regulatory policies. California is one of the toughest on both of those. But, you know, this move was different because unlike other companies that have left, it strikes me from what Musk has said, this was mostly about social policy.
Yep, it definitely was, wasn't it? You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Chinese authorities have banned PricewaterhouseCoopers China for 6 months and fined it almost $62 million after saying that staff had concealed, even condoned fraud in audit failures related to the collapsed property developer Evergrande. Francine McKenna is a professor of financial accounting and a journalist who specializes in the work of the big four global accountancy businesses. So the perfect person to talk to about this. This is pretty embarrassing for one of the world's big accountancy firms, isn't it, Francine?
Really, it is. And it's especially so because it's been a long time coming. We knew this was coming. And so PwC globally, not just in China, has had to sort of sit on its hands and wait until the final fines and sanctions were announced.
Because we'll get into the implications for the company in a minute, but you know, the collapse of Evergrande has had massive implications for the Chinese economy. Some say, you know, it's the beginning of the sort of demise of the whole housing industry.
Yes, to try to get the attention of U.S. Readers, you know, they've compared it to Enron, compared it to the Madoff scandal, and it just, just swallows those whole 10 times. It's huge, and it's had a significant impact on the Chinese economy, which is why I think the Chinese government has decided to take such draconian actions.
There are four big accountancy firms, aren't there? EY, KPMG and Deloitte. What sort of implications could this have for PwC worldwide in terms of reputational damage?
Well, the reputational hit from a worldwide perspective has been limited up until this point, but I was doing a little media survey earlier today, and the news is all over the place. It's in every publication, everywhere, in every language. So certainly the language that the Chinese government used about cover-ups and complicity is very, very damaging. However, the Chinese practice, the Chinese audits are a very limited part of what the global network of firms does.
Chris, you obviously work in the world of finance. Give us a sense of the ripples of this particular case.
Well, I think it's really striking. We used to do a tremendous amount of business in China and have pulled back in the last decade. One of the reasons is it's always been difficult, in part, to be honest, because, frankly, the government there does not like bad news. If things start to go badly, They discourage the kind of honesty that you would expect from one of the big accountancy firms. I think if I were in their shoes, I wouldn't have been there in the first place. They chose to be there and do the business, but I suspect it wasn't entirely their decision to hide some of the things going on at Evergrande.
Okay, let us see what happens with that. Francine, we know that there are a lot of tensions between, you know, the EU, the US and China. Is it could some of these big accountancy firms get trapped up into that with China worried about how, you know, the likes of the US are going to react to its EVs, its electric vehicles? Could it be a bit of tit for tat, the Chinese saying we don't want these big foreign accountancy firms in our country?
No, I really don't think that that's an issue. In fact, there had been a little bit of a freeze up until recently, and recently the Chinese government allowed the U.S. Audit regulator, the PCAOB, in to start doing inspections. So I think that the Chinese government had maybe reached its last nerve in terms of the level of work that these global firms were doing in China, and decided that it was going to cut them down to size, because there was a recent fine also by the Chinese government against the Deloitte China firm. And so I think that they would probably see other governments like the U.S., Australia, which is having its own issues with PwC in Australia, probably applaud them taking a stern look, because it means that the rest of the stern actions by these other governments will be sort of not out there alone.
Francine, thank you so much for joining us on the program. PwC has said PwC China has a long history of high quality audits, and we do not believe that the behavior of a very small number of our team members is representative of the work of the vast majority of PwC China. Let's stay on the China theme, because it has about 100 or so electric vehicle brands. That, though, has left a lot of companies starving as the competition drives prices lower. Some of them are looking to go abroad, but as we know, the likes of the EU and the US and China are putting tariffs on those products. The government argues Chinese EVs are given an unfair edge through China's subsidies. But is that the only reason that China can afford to produce such cheap cars? Jennifer Pak, Marketplace's China correspondent, has been to Chongqing City in southwest China.
In Chongqing's Wanzhou district, rideshare driver Zhang Fenglian doubles as a local guide and takes me on the scenic route along the Yangtze River. It's a quiet ride because, like many rideshare cars in Chinese megacities, this one is fully electric. It's from top Chinese EV seller BYD. The model Qing is, he says, not perfect.
Its standard range on one charge is supposed to be 280 miles, but I can get only 255 to 260 miles, and only if I don't turn on the air conditioning.
The interior is basic, there's not even air vents in the back, but it's a practical car, he says.
Of course, if you care about appearances, you wouldn't use this car to pick up important clients or a big bus because the car looks cheap. But this car can fit 5 passengers comfortably. Plus, the trunk is big.
And the price tag? Just $18,000, which would be a steal in the U.S. The cheapest EV you can buy in the States is around $29,000. And in the European Union, Canada, and the U.S., Chinese EV exports face punitive tariffs. So what's so bad about these affordable EVs being available outside of China?
In theory, there's nothing wrong, but in practice, there's a lot wrong.
That's the U.S. ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns.
Because the government of China and their provincial governments are subsidizing the Chinese EV manufacturers so that there's no level playing field. And they take the cars, they sell them below the cost of production into Europe or Brazil or the U.S.
China denies this, saying its subsidies are reasonable. And it's not just domestic car makers that benefit. The Chinese government also offered Tesla a sweet deal to set up a factory in China, says Bill Russo with the Shanghai-based strategy firm Automobility.
It was Tesla who broke through and showed you can be profitable.
Tesla has previously denied reports that it might export its Shanghai-made cars to the U.S., but manufacturing in China has helped Tesla and Chinese brands lower EV prices globally, partly thanks to China's hardworking and low-paid labor force. In central China's Changsha City, there's a steady trickle of people going through the gates to the BYD recruitment center. They're all carrying suitcases because they're out-of-towners. If they get hired, and many do, they can stay in the company's dorm and start work the next day. A car assembly worker, Mr. Wu, says he's been working at BYD for the past 6 months.
I can earn about $1,000 a month.
Not bad for factory work in China these days, except that it includes overtime, which they have to work to make a livable wage.
Per month, I work 270 to 280 hours and get 1 or 2 days off.
Meaning Mr. Wu earns, at best, about $3.60 an hour, working at least 67 hours per week, versus an average of $28 for auto factory workers in the U.S. last year. BYD and other major China EV makers did not respond to Marketplace's request for an interview. Perhaps their biggest advantage is China's comprehensive supply chain, or vertical integration.
You are your own supplier of the critical ingredients that go into the electric vehicle cake.
Ingredients like batteries, says EV analyst Bill Russo. And by making lots and lots of them, the price comes down. Back in Chongqing, driver Zhang Fenglian is playing music from his cell phone app because his basic model doesn't include an entertainment system. But BYD's latest commercials advertise that its newer models come automatically with tech features, like voice control to play the radio or an app to start the AC from a cell phone. Bill Russo says they're appealing to technology shoppers.
You know, this coolness factor of I'm bragging about something other than how it drives.
So the next wave of Chinese EVs come with more smart device features. And he says compared to their foreign counterparts, they'll be less expensive in China and beyond.
Chris, Jennifer Pack reporting there and really pointing out quite vividly there that for a lot of car companies, it's going to be tough to compete against the Chinese.
The big thing is the wage differential. It's just massive. And on top of that, here in the U.S., not only are wages higher, but overtime wages are almost punitive because that's a big part of the contract negotiation as well.
Yep, Chris, it is one of the topics of our time, isn't it? Thanks so much for joining us on the program on Business Matters. We're going to hear an interview from somebody within the U.S. drugs industry on steps being taken there against Chinese products. That is it for World Business Report.
The most famous wrestler in Iranian history.
When Gholamreza Takhti entered, there was chaos.
Whose legend is surrounded by mystery.
Really? Takhti died? How come?
Immediately the rumors started.
Legend of Takhti.
Was Takhti actually trying to provoke the regime?
Part of amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service.
There's this massive landslide of myth, and somewhere in there is the truth.
Search for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.